This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Matt, Brett here. Brett, I thought we had a deal with Mother Nature in March. What the hell was that? Of course, there is nothing greater than when you look at cities that got the most snow in this last snowstorm, your own town is right there. That's nice. I went to bed at 10:30 on Saturday night. My daughter got home. I was like, good night. I said, pull your car in the driveway. It's supposed to snow a little bit. I just don't want it to be icy out there. Because remember, we were supposed to, at that point, get like an inch of ice, right? I wake up, there's 6 inches of snow outside. What the heck? And by the way, thanks for just letting the sun take care of it, plow guys. Thank you. That's very, what the, I went and drove to the Y yesterday morning at 10, and there was like one lane open on 169. At 10, it had been snowing for like, it ended snowing like 7 hours earlier. It was not a pleasant drive.
Well, more cost effective to use the sun, I guess.
It is doing a fine job now. It is starting to warm up out there. But I thought we had a deal. I thought we had a deal, Mother Nature. It's March. We're not supposed to do this. I know. It's Minnesota. It does happen. It's going to actually get pretty cold this week, too. We should mention that. It's going to be a chilly week this week. But next week, we're back up in the 40s. That should start melting things off nicely in the state of Minnesota. A lot to get to today. Some interesting stuff about Ukraine. We'll get to Minnesota coronavirus update. But if you've listened to the show over the last few months, we've tried to feature some dedicated interviews where we're talking about the state of mental health in America. Because last summer, I talked to two nurses who were that specialize in mental health. They're nurses within the mental health field. And they kind of looked at me and said, we are staring at the precipice of a huge problem right now. We don't have enough funding. We do not have enough staff. We do not have enough facilities. And we don't have enough understanding from the public of how big the mental health problem that we are about to, you know, take on in this country is, and how widespread it is from young children all the way to the elderly. It is a massive problem out there, and we need to deal with it. We've talked about staffing issues. We've talked about rural America and the lack of quality, a quality healthcare system for mental health in rural America. But we also want to focus on schools. And if you saw the Star Tribune story today, and the story that had to deal with the one of the reasons why the teachers there are thinking about are going on strike is because of a lack of mental health services in schools. Now, to understand this issue better, and I'm not going to focus not so much on the strike. I want to focus more though on what is going on in the schools and the problem that schools are facing, not just here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, but statewide and nationwide as well. Jill Cook is the executive director of the American School Counselor Association, a former middle school counselor and elementary middle school assistant principal. She's been at ASCA for more than 20 years. She's kind enough today to join us to talk about the impending crisis we're going to have with mental health in our schools. Jill, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
I think this is a problem. We need to have a lot more conversations about this, not just on this show, but everywhere, because we are seeing the beginnings of a massive mental health crisis in this country. And right now, I just don't think there's a lot of people that understand the magnitude and the widespread nature of how this is going to affect all of us as a society. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. And you did use the word impending, but I would say that we've had a mental health crisis for some time, even among young people. And I think we're just now beginning to realize that and understand that. We know that 1 in 5 children have some kind of mental health issue. That has been the case. But the pandemic and the trauma that has been experienced by all over the last 2 years has certainly heightened that.
I was, by one of your colleagues, I was slightly corrected today, and I'm glad she did. There's a mentality, and I don't know if this is a 1980s or 70s or 60s mentality, but there's this mentality that the problem that we're having with mental health in our education system with our students is pretty much focused on high school kids, maybe kids as they go through puberty, so younger teens into the high school age. But the reality is that is a misnomer. Right now, the mental health crisis goes all the way down to kindergarten, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't even say that there's an age restriction on how we think about mental health. I have a 25-year-old daughter who was diagnosed with bipolar when she was 9, diagnosed with ADHD when she was 6. And we knew early on there was something regarding the wiring of her brain that made her reactions different than our other children. So it's not limited by age.
So the question that comes to my mind is, were we just not focusing on this issue, or is it something that's been developing and becoming a larger? I mean, let's face it, social media is a nightmare. I'm a parent myself. Yeah. It's a nightmare raising kids in the age of social media. But I do have to ask the question: when you go back to the 60s, 70s, 80s, was this just something we were convincing ourselves there wasn't really this problem, and there was actually a larger problem there that was unaddressed?
I think so. A lot of it has to do with the stigmatization of mental health. I even remember growing up and just within my own family, it was the thing you said under hushed tones.
Yeah.
It wasn't acknowledged. It wasn't. I have a family member who would drive 30 minutes away to go see a psychologist because didn't want people in the hometown to know that that's where they went. So I think part of what's happened is we have had a lot of campaigns and awareness campaigns about mental health, about mental illness, about suicide awareness and prevention. And that's wonderful because we all need to know and be aware. And so it's raised the awareness, and hopefully we're working on destigmatizing the conversation about mental health and mental illness and about seeking help. When there are concerns, it's okay to get help.
Well, and I think about the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They have the mental health facility there, and that was up until really the mid 70s what mental health facilities were. It was this very institutionalized kind of care. Today, it is a much more vibrant sort of system. But now let's look at this from the school's point of view. School counselors have been there, but it clearly seems to me at this point the idea and the role of your standard school counselor is being overwhelmed by the magnitude of the mental health crisis. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think it certainly contributes to the load that school counselors have. And I think it's important to note that as we talk about the 70s and 80s, today school counselors is not the guidance counselor of old, mm-hmm. where the perception was they just worked with high school kids or getting into college or just kids in trouble. Today's school counselor, we have them kindergarten through 12th grade, and these individuals work with all students in a school around academic development, career development, and the social and emotional development piece. So it's a very comprehensive approach to how school counselors support students. But the fact is, yes, there are lots of social and emotional needs. There are children who are experiencing mental health concerns. So, what does that mean for a school? We know, research tells us, children can't learn. Students mm-hmm. can't learn if they're experiencing these issues. And our whole goal at the school is to teach children. So if they're having other issues, then what does that mean for a school? And I think that gets at what you were talking about leading into this. We need to ensure that we have proper staffing in schools, that we have school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers, school nurses, because we know often mental health concerns can manifest themselves as a physical issue. Lots of children go to the nurse with a tummy ache or a headache wanting to go home, and it's often, not always, but sometimes the result of something else going on.
Well, and when I was a kid, I grew up in the 80s, 70s and 80s. It's like you're feeling a little depressed. The coach will take you out back. It's like, buck up there, camper, now do 3 laps. And you're like, okay, this was a really bad way of dealing with this, but that's kind of how it was. It is interesting because I think that when you look nationally, we're in Minnesota. Minnesota's got pretty good schools. I mean, we do fund, we do have a variety of cases. I mean, I know that there's a lot of school districts in other states where they don't even have a school nurse anymore.
Right.
And so trying to convince them to, you know, you need psychological and, you know, mental health specialists on campus is almost a lost cause. When did this mentality talking about the counselor and the role of the counselor and how it needed to change, when did that start becoming the focus, that this was not, you know, it wasn't no longer just a school counselor for high school kids to help them mm-hmm. learn about colleges? When did the people start realizing, you know what, there's a need here that is not being covered, and these counselors are going to have to be the ones that are going to have to take care of it?
Right. So it's been coming for about 30 years, but it's really been since approximately 2003 when our association, the American School Counselor Association, released a document that was a framework for what comprehensive school counseling program should look like. So it gave us a common language, a common approach. It the big shift was about using student and school data to look at student needs, school needs, look at gaps, and then to develop your goals and programs for the year based on that data. It wasn't just random acts of guidance and hugs and hankies and things you might think about your guidance counselor of old. It's really proactive work to support students so they can be successful and have positive outcomes. So that it's been a time coming. And as we think about this mental health piece, you know, it's not, school counselors do not do therapy. They do not diagnose, they do not prescribe medication. But I think the biggest shift as we think about the mental health needs of our communities is that it's work that cannot be done in silos. Schools have a piece, school counselors have a piece, working with kiddos and families, educating teachers and staff and coaches and bus drivers and cafeteria workers about signs to look for and what to do when they have concerns about a student, working with the school district, having those collaborative relationships with community agencies that can provide support, working with faith-based institutions to help provide support and services to families. So I think how we have the real shift in this thinking is around that it's not siloed work. It has to be a systemic, systematic, collaborative approach.
And I like how you described it there, because it's not, these are not the individual students, you know, direct psychologist or psychiatrist or counselor. It's more of an overview of what's going on, being able to identify a problem and helping the school to be able to navigate those waters. And I think that's
right.
It's an important. So when did all this, you talked about 2003 with your organization starting to say, okay, things need to change here. When did you start noticing that, okay, this is no longer just high school or even junior high, that the elementary school kids as well, we need to have appropriate counseling in those schools too?
Oh my gosh. Well, there have been elementary school counselors around forever, just not in the same numbers that we had in middle and high school. And so it depended on funding at a state level or a district level. But the good news now is because there's this attention, there is funding to ensure that we have school counselors, kindergarten through 12th grade. In the State of the Union address last week, or in his fact sheet afterward, the president has pledged to double the number of school counselors and school psychologists based on funding that has come from the federal level thus far. The national numbers, we've had a 17% increase in the hiring of school counselors. We know that the national ratio has gone down. It's right now it's one school counselor for every 415 students. Last year it was 424 students, but we recommend a ratio of one school counselor for every 250 students. And in Minnesota, the ratio was 1 to 592.
Wow. So yeah, Minnesota is actually falling behind in this category.
Well, this year it's certainly more than what the national average is. Yes.
Once again, Executive Director of the American School Counselor Association is Jill Cook, kind enough to join us today to talk about this crisis that's ongoing right now with mental health in our schools. So let's talk about the last 2 years, because this is what seems to have ramped up, you know, the people in the medical profession as well as organizations like yourself, is that they could see, you know, of course, a pandemic, no one could predict it. It's something which is you know, it's something that, you know, affected all of us, small towns, big cities, everyone, mm-hmm. Including the teachers who did a magnificent job of rolling with this and having to create this. But it did create this problem of kids need to have some level of social interaction. Well, what do you do when you can't have that because a pandemic is limiting the contact that you can have? You know, talk a little bit about this and how this has magnified the problem.
Exactly. I mean, just think about it. Two years ago, it was right about now, 2 years ago, when things started shutting down. And I've heard stories about some schools like shut down immediately. There was no warning. Teachers didn't have their stuff. They didn't have the laptops. And so one, just the loss of the routine and the structure, and then the learning about doing virtual education, and then the trying to track down students that schools were concerned about. And some students they still haven't heard from 2 years later, don't know what happened to them. And then we think about this shared trauma, this shared pandemic. It's not an isolated event like a natural disaster might be for a community. This was a pandemic, and it was shared trauma as we learned how to wear masks and be socially distant and had to stay home for quite some time. And you add to that loss. I mean, people who were sick, people who passed away, families that were impacted from this virus. And then, I mean, where you are, thinking about in the summer of 2020 when we had all the protests, yes. As we think about the social inequities and injustices taking place and after the murder of George Floyd. So students were exposed to a lot. Teachers were exposed to a lot. That is some shared trauma. And there are school districts who are recognizing mental health days for teachers and mental health days for students, really working to try and get community agencies into the schools or at least accessible. But there's a lot of work to be done.
It's interesting. My son graduated 2020. My oldest child graduated from high school in 2020. And it was interesting to hear the differences. Now, my experiences were with high school and junior high kids and my own family where, you know, oh, we missed prom. We missed our graduation. And I'm not saying that those aren't, you know, depressing to a point, but it's not. There seemed to be, especially with a lot of my friends who had elementary school kids, a darkness to what was going on, that their kids seemed sadder, that the kids were more lethargic, that the kids were, I mean, the glowing rectangles that we all have, whether that's our phones or this TV screen or computer, is that they had taken over, and it's how do you turn that off? And it was, especially in the day and age, and we talked about social media, in the day and age when a lot of parents, when they get home, they get on social media. So it becomes even more compounded there. So, you know, the difference here, once again, when you talk about counselors, it's not just being able to change what the counselor's role has been historically, but it's also being able to direct that counselor to have a better influence, considering the problems that the high school kids are having is very different than the problems the junior high kids were having and the elementary school kids as well.
Well, and as you think about middle school and high school, as we think about hormones and how the fact of the matter is kids functioning significantly changes. And as you know, is what we are seeing or experiencing, is it typical adolescence or is it something more troubling that we need to be concerned about? So, with those ages, there's a lot going on. But it's you know, we want to give kids supports at whatever the age. I will share one statistic as you were talking about what parents were seeing. So a couple of weeks ago, an organization called Hopeful Futures released a report on essentially mental health at the community level across all 50 states, looking at schools, community supports, the number of school counselors and psychologists. And they have some statistics that says 31% of parents say that their children's emotional health is worse now than before the pandemic. And, you know, I think that probably rings true. We know that during the pandemic in 2020, the emergency room visits experienced by children 5 to 11 during the pandemic increased 24% because, and they went to the emergency room for mental health related emergency rooms, and for 12 to 17 year olds increased 31% for mental health related emergency room visits. That's pretty scary.
That's terrifying. That's terrifying. That's outright terrifying. And you bring that up, and one of the things that should be noted is this is not a city. You know, you'd mentioned the George Floyd protest, and I mean, obviously, 2020 was a very interesting year in Minneapolis. That's for sure. I mean, there was a lot going on, and yeah, there was a lot of conversations parents were having to have with kids, not only pandemic related, but George Floyd related as well. But this is more than that. I mean, this is something as well that the problem in rural America, and I know this because we've talked to people that talked about staffing issues generally, not just in the schools, but generally for mental health. And the void of mental health professionals in rural America is quite shocking. And so you do have this problem as well in rural America where you've got to convince people who might even have a teacher shortage. Well, you got to make room here for a counselor in this school. Someone has to.
Well, exactly. And often, and again, school counselors don't do therapy. That is not their role. But often those school psychologists, school counselors are the only individuals in a rural community who can help address this, knowing that the nearest child psychologist or psychiatrist might be an hour or two away for many. I don't know how the last 2 years, and in terms of being able to access mental health professionals via video or electronically, I don't know how that shifted or what that might mean, but that's something that maybe it could be more accessible now that we're all more comfortable with the medium.
It's interesting. Schools are an interesting place because not only do they get forced to do some things with, you know, generally unfunded, and they have to do a lot of things, but it's interesting to see how they themselves, because of the way that society is, they are sometimes the canary in the coal mine. They find the problems before they come to light. I mean, whether it's, you know, school lunches, hunger in schools, for goodness sakes, is something that the school districts have really championed and tried to fight hunger in their students. Because once again, if you're hungry, you're not going to learn. Like sex education, stuff like this. It was one of those things where the idea was, oh, people will talk about this at home. But when it wasn't, and you're having, you know, teen pregnancy becoming a real crisis or drugs becoming a real crisis, there became a dependence on the school to try to help out in those cases. This is the same thing. I mean, this is, you guys are seeing this precipice ahead of us, or even as we start to go over the edge of it. And you're realizing that the schools might be considering, a lot of people are not stepping up here and doing what needs to be done because it is such a large problem. And it kind of is one of those things that gets glossed over or pushed to the side. The reality is that the schools are starting to act now because they're the ones that are seeing the problem coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, students can't learn if there are other issues that aren't attended to.
Indeed.
And you said it, schools do a lot. They're often the anchors of communities. They feed the students. They're their sports, their social outlets, sometimes their arts outlets. So we ask a lot of schools, and we need more teachers. We need more school counselors. The impending educator shortage is as scary as the student mental health shortage in terms of who will be in the schools to work with these young people.
Indeed. Let's not candy coat it. I mean, we have to make sure everyone's out there. I want you to talk right now. How bad is this problem going to get? And what if you had a dream list? And I put it out there, put out your dream list of what it would take for America to be able to handle this impending mental health crisis within our teenagers in schools. What would you like to see happen today?
Well, it's such a complex question and such a complex issue, but clearly given my lens in my association is I would want every student to have access to a school counselor. That is my dream. I want every student to have the 1-to-250 ratio and have access to a qualified school counselor, and also have those other individuals in schools, school psychologists, school social workers, school nurses, who can help address these issues in school. And then, you know, we have to think about, again, continuing the conversation, continuing the destigmatization of the issue, looking at the community supports. I mean, it's very complex. The Surgeon General released a report in December that looked at it very systemically, looking at all these groups in a community that need to be engaged in this mental health crisis to help do this work. Because again, it can, if it's just one pillar, just one silo, then nothing's going to happen. So absolutely, school is a critical piece of this, and we want school counselors in schools, but it's bigger than that.
And I should mention a number you're saying, and this is not political. This is just numbers. Your recommendation from your organization, the American School Counselor Association, is one counselor for every 250 kids. In Minnesota right now, that ratio is one for every 592. That's woefully inadequate.
Yes.
All right. We just burned in half hour here. You're really easy. I really had to pull back on a lot of questions because there are so many more questions I have here. This is really, you know, Jill, I got to tell you the truth. This is, the more I learn about this problem, the more, you know, kind of scared I'm getting about it, because it is so large, and not just the as we talk about counselors and mental health within schools, but the mental health overall. You know, and just whether it's the taxation of the hospitals because there isn't any place else to take people that are having a mental health episode or something like this.
Yes.
This is something that we have to put every alarm out right now, because if we're not dealing with this, this is going to become a much bigger problem.
Well, and we want everyone, teachers, everybody who works with the young person, everybody who works with anyone, it's not just a school issue, to know the warning signs, to know the phone numbers to call when you need help, to know the community resources, to know that when somebody pulls away or they start giving away their things or their the students' grades drop or their peer group changes, some of those things that can be concerning and could be a signal that something's up. Everybody needs to know what those warning signs are and need to know what to do when they have concerns.
Schoolcounselor.org. Schoolcounselor.org is your website, correct?
That is correct.
I'm going to link to that on social media. People want to find out more information about this and how you can help and how you can help your local school and talk to your school boards, by all means. Jill, a pleasure. You are, by all means, welcome back anytime you would like to come back. I'd love to have you back again.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for focusing on this very, very important topic.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you very much for all your time. Jill Cook, the Executive Director of the American School Counselor Association, will take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Jill Cook, an outstanding interview. We'll spotlight that one for sure. And I'm going to try to highlight this as much as I can. We have got a serious problem in this country when it comes to mental health and our kids and mental health overall. And these last 2 years have been really rough. And it's like, you know, it's not like, I know conservatives won't go out there. It's like, well, then you shouldn't have done that. Well, no, you had to. Like I said, when we had to shut down this country three times with the original virus, with the Delta variant, and then with Omicron, when we had to shut it down every time, I said the same thing. What's to like? There's nothing to like here. But I'm sure as hell not going to be a selfish jackass that sits out there and says, I don't care how many people I kill. I want my appetizers from Applebee's. And that literally was the counterpoint right there. I'm saying, hey, let's save lives. They're like, do you know they got a 2-for-1 deal on Tuesdays? I'm the real victim here. Yeah, okay, whatever. You got a massive problem with mental health. And a lot of it, in my mind, has to do with, and I can say this because I have friends who live overseas in Ireland, in England, in Germany, in France, in Italy. People I know that I've known for many years, and they say the difference is, one of them made this point to me, he goes, my country at least cares for us, unlike the United States, which is a cold thing to say, but is 1,000% true. Take a look at Texas. A year ago, when the government's mismanagement of their own power system caused people to freeze to death in their own house, and basically the mentality was, this is God sorting them out today. You know, you're like, wow, really? And that's where we're at. And we need to have a country that cares about its people again. And that's not about caring about a handful of millionaires and billionaires and getting them as much tax dollars as possible. This is about caring about the people. And right now, you've got one political party in the Republicans, and I have no problem in saying this, that could give a rat's butt about the people. That when faced with real world crises about the health and well-being of the American people, they say, well, it sucks to be them. And that's that. That is part of the problem. I'm getting tired of rural America spitting out the daily story. I was against all kind of health care ideas, and then my kid got sick. Why wasn't the government there? Yeah, sure, I was at every rally telling the government to keep their nose out of my business, but the second I got sick, they should have known they needed to help me. Did you elect people that are going to help you? No, you didn't. You elected Republicans in rural America, in rural Minnesota. You elected Republicans. They don't care about you. You can have a child who has a serious mental health issue at the counselors, and you can have the schools have the counselors identify it and tell you, you know, you need to talk with someone. You need to do something here. And you don't have the facilities or the counselors anywhere nearby you. And instead, your politician's saying, I'm not going to help you in your namby-pamby state. If you want a cuddle puppy in a quiet room, well, you need to go to liberal stand. I'm not going to do that here. And then all of a sudden, your kid has a real mental crisis and mental breakdown. And you're like, why isn't the state helping me? Well, because who did you elect? This is a legitimate problem. If I can make some advice here, and I'm going to get into the story of the Star Tribune had today. If I can get into one thing I'm going to suggest to you, parents, you need to talk to your kids. Now, there is this mentality, and I'm going to be honest with you. I think to a point my wife and I, with our three kids, kind of got down this path a little bit ourselves, where your kids get to be a certain age and you kind of disconnect. And the reality is that we have learned that you need to parent all the way, really, till your kids get out of the house at 18. But and no, don't sit there and say, well, my kid's 16 and they're an illegal adult. And they're well, you still need to parent them. And frankly, there's times I've needed to parent my kid at college. And there's this mentality that once you get your kid, they're 12, they're 13, they go from elementary school to junior high. Well, I'm done. No, you're not. And if you're not checking in with your kids, if you're not talking to your kids, if you're coming home and the most important thing for you is trying to take a few selfies so that you can update Instagram or whatever, well, you need to put down the phones and you need to talk to your kids and find out what's going on. And you do need to know where your kids are going online and who they're talking to online. It does your kid no good to go through school and then and be berated at school and then be berated constantly at home. This is part of the reason why this mental health crisis is exploding in this country, is that it was bad before. And don't get me wrong, there was definitely mental abuse in schools, you know, for years. But the kid could go home and there would be some sort of respite during the day or during the night and on the weekends. Now, thanks to social media, it never ends. It never ends. It's not a surprise to me we had a massive mental health crisis within our kids. It doesn't. And the question is, what are we going to do to solve it? I mean, once again, we need to have more counselors. We need to have more spending. We need to have more understanding and more resources for the counselors in these schools. Many Minneapolis and school counselors have caseloads topping 450 students, almost twice the workload recommended by the American School Counselor Association. District officials and teachers union leaders agree the need for those mental health services is higher than ever and that boosting support for students is a priority. But coming up with the staffing plan to do that and how to write it into a contract has proven a sticking point in the bargaining table amid stalled contract negotiations. Absent resolutions on that issue and others, including pay and class size limits, teachers, union members on both sides of the river are all ready to go on strike on Tuesday morning. Union leaders have been pushing for contract language to ensure each school has a team of counselors, social workers, and school psychologists. District leaders, however, say adding such clauses can limit flexibility as they address shrinking enrollment and budget shortfalls. But you can't have that. I mean, the Sahan Journal had that story where you had the one woman who was an IT person with the school district, but because she spoke Somali, all of a sudden the school was calling on her to be an interpreter for half the freaking day, which is not her job. And the reality is, if you're hiring someone to teach chemistry, well, then they can't be your go-to school counselor. They can't be, you know, they can't get more, you know, be their healthcare specialist. They need more social workers, school psychologists. They need more. And right now, and by the way, we have a massive budget surplus in St. Paul right now. A massive budget surplus. and hardly anyone is talking about this problem. Between this and the interview we had over the holidays, where we talked about the complete lack of some communities don't even have a family counselor, let alone a child psychologist in rural Minnesota. I mean, my God, you have an immediate need. Instead, what we get is, you know, well, I've got to give a tax break to someone. This problem is, like I said, you can see a massive problem coming. And yet there just doesn't seem to be any interest, particularly from the Republicans, to do anything about it. Because they've convinced themselves mental health issues are just namby-pamby liberals looking for an emotional comfort puppy. And I'm not going to give it to them. Seriously, that's the problem that we've got right now, is this conservative mentality in this country. We need to have a country that actually cares for its people, like a lot of countries do. But we don't do that anymore here. And the United States does not care about its people. It just does not. It's a selfish, greedy country right now that only cares about, you know, what am I going to get out of it? And nothing highlights that more than the last 2 years of a pandemic, watching one entire political party argue that, I don't think we should do anything to save people. They're old. They need to die anyway. It's amazing. It's amazing. You guys on the right who keep sitting there saying, whatever happened to a good old-fashioned Mayberry America? Well, your greedy-ass jackasses that you inherit in your party, they're the ones that basically, that's what it is. Your party doesn't care about the American people. It doesn't care about the American. It does not care about the. It absolutely does not. No, it does not. Not the Republican Party of America does not care about the American people. It cares about pushing its will on the American people. And when they hear something like, oh, we've got a mental health crisis, the first reaction is not, oh, my God, what do we need to do? We got a budget surplus. How can we help? It's, you're a bunch of namby-pamby wusses that need to be spanked, and that will straighten you out. Ground them from their phone. See? Problem solved. And you wonder how you got into a problem like this. I just keep wondering if we really want the same things. Why is it taking so long to get there? Said Kelsey Clark, a school counselor at South High School in Minneapolis, a member of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers bargaining team. Mediation sessions are closed to the public and negotiating team members are not allowed to discuss the details of proposals on the table. An update from St. Paul Schools after Wednesday's mediation session said the district and union had reached 4 tentative agreements and had thoughtful discussions on several major issues, including mental health support for students. In Minneapolis, mediation sessions have run as long as 12 hours in recent days. In the event of the strike, all classes would be canceled. Both districts have told families to stay tuned for announcements via email, textbooks, and robocalls. And once again, it's clear the teachers have got a very legitimate point. The teachers have got a very legitimate point. They're not, and it does not help the city of Minneapolis that they're negotiating the police contract right now. It does, and they're what, 78,000, 79,000? And you're still saying, well, we can't pay the teachers more than $32,000 a year. Really? Teachers, really? You can't? Dear Lord, that's part of your problem. That's part of your problem right there. These teachers have been so disrespected over the years, and the salaries have not kept up with the cost of living even. And now all of a sudden you basically have teachers working full-time who are holding 2 to 3 jobs at a school district, only one of which they're qualified for. And you're paying them basically glorified minimum wage. Shall we do Matt's math corner on that one? I think it was 35 was the amount she was getting paid. That woman that was mentioned in the Sahan Journal. So if I was, well, I'll make it 36. That'll make it easier. 36,000 divided by 52 divided by 40 equals, you're making $17 an hour. Isn't that a waitress at a bar? It's making $17 an hour, but as opposed to getting you the correct drinks to the table, they're taking care of the children of the city. We need people that are going to care, that are not going to just sit back and tell us what you can't do, to tell us what you can do. That's the old military thing. And that's one of the reasons why I kind of look at the way I do is when you're in the military, if you're in a crisis situation, they tell you, don't focus on what you don't have. Look at what you do have and figure out a solution. And there's not too many people that can say, there's a lot of people that will tell you, oh, we don't have the money for this. We can't do this. Well, find a solution. There's a solution to build a freaking football stadium in that city. There's got to be a solution to pay the teachers what they deserve. If there's enough money there to build sports arena for every freaking team in town that's worth millions and millions of dollars for billionaire owners, then there sure is enough money to go around for school counselors to prevent an epic mental health crisis, which will cripple this country. So make it happen. Don't tell me what you don't have. Tell me what you do have and how you're going to make this work. Because if your whole goal is to basically say, I'm going to negotiate them down, they're not going to get too much. You're an ass. You're an ass. Just let me know. You're actually paying teachers who are holding two full-time jobs down less than $40,000 a year. And they've got a college degree. You guys got some serious problems there. And I'm not making light of this. The problem has been is that they'll try to get you to sacrifice one thing to get a minimum increase in another area. That if you get rid of all the mental health spending, if you get rid of all the counselors and all the psychiatrists and all the social workers, you get rid of all of them, then we'll give you a 0.0009% increase in your salary. See? Compromise. Part of the reason these problems exist is because you guys have absolutely underpaid and underdelivered to teachers for decades. Decades. And it's time to pay the bill. This is the reason why in the last year you've had a lot of people saying, the heck with you. I'm not going to come work for you if you're going to pay me basically $13 an hour to work around a whole bunch of people with COVID 40 hours a day and act as if getting me $13.50 an hour demands I actually have to work 80 hours a week. You guys have purposely kept the working class in the gutter. And now they're tired of it and they're coming out of it. And so you're going to have to figure out a way. And no, you can't just sacrifice every other thing. You can't sacrifice the transportation. You can't sacrifice the mental health care. You can't sacrifice the quality of school care. You can't basically say, oh, we're going to hire teachers who are going to make minimum wage and they're just going to teach a test. That's a really crappy idea. That's a stupid, stupid idea. Don't do that. But your plan had better have some real, real teeth to it when it comes to dealing with this mental health crisis, because this mental health crisis is going to be a freaking nightmare if we do not put the time and money and resources into it. We need to today. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I'm going to try to get even more people on to talk about mental health care. I've made some inquiries into the head of mental health down at the Mayo Clinic, and I want to try to get them on the air to talk about this more, because we've talked about resources, we've talked about staffing, we've talked about rural Minnesota, we've talked now about schools, but we need to have more. And no, it's the people who do not want to spend the money on this emerging problem are the ones who basically sit there and say, I'm not going to pay billions of dollars for some cuddle puppies for some whiny kids. And that's the way they basically say that doesn't exist. But then, let's take a look at the amount of kids who have shot up schools and shot up other facilities. That's not something that happened. I'm not going to deny the fact that the ease and convenience of you can get a gun has played a role in that. But I would also make an argument the lack of mental health care within our schools to identify problems has also been a huge problem in this. And I think we need to have more of. Clearly, we need to stop problems before they get really bad. Gary is in Minneapolis. You wanted to chime in on the teacher strike. Welcome on in, Gary.
Yeah, first of all, you know, John Cabby, he started deinstitutionalization. I remember he said that mental illness and what they now call developmentally disabled, there was a public health problem, number one. I think they may still be. That mental illness stuff is more deadly than people realize. And I just thought about the strikes, too. I think they're waking up around, they had enough of this crap, the rich grabbing everything. People are starting going on strike all over the country. These college teachers, it ain't just what they make. They got a huge college debt, all kinds of people that went to college. It's terrible.
Thanks, Gary. I appreciate it. Yeah, the amount of money you're paying to go to college. The reality is that you should be getting paid enough to where you're retiring and writing off your last student loan check. I don't think that should be, that doesn't make any sense to me. I had a friend of mine who's in his 60s, who is up on the range, and his mother, he opened up to me about this a long time ago. And I'm going to be vague enough. I don't think it upset him too much to share what he told me. But he said his mother had alcoholism issues and was also, you know, today would be a litany of anxiety, bipolar disorder, stuff like that. Back then, they called her loony or loopy or whatever it is. And they threw her into a sanatorium because back then, that's how they treated both alcoholism and mental health issues. Just chuck them into a sanitarium. And if you watch the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that is exactly what these facilities used to look like. These very, you know, there wasn't a lot of mental health help then. It was just a place to lock people up to get them away from other people. And he was a young kid, and he said, I'll never forget my dad taking me to go see her in this place, and it scared the living daylights out of me. And, you know, it really affected him. And even still today, he sort of said, I feel as if my mom, there was something seriously wrong with his mom. Now, this day and age, you can get, and parents go to counselors, you got facilities that are geared specifically for mental health issues. But if you're not paying attention, counselors are overwhelmed. Try to find a counselor. Most counselors are completely booked up right now. These mental health facilities that are there to help people, many of them are already full. We have a real serious problem that if we don't address now, is going to end up costing us so much more later down the road. And we can fix this. We can fix this. Getting the counselors and the social workers in the schools. Getting much more rural mental health. I mean, for goodness sakes. And encouraging people to get into the mental health field. Those would be some really big steps forward. Absolutely. Hour two of the show, that's coming up next.
Portions of the following program may be pre-recorded.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Matt, Adam in here today. This breaking news, by the way, I should mention this. The Supreme Court basically, I think it was a 6-3 ruling, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch ruling that basically, no, we got to be able to gerrymander. They rejected the GOP redistricting pleas in two states, North Carolina and Pennsylvania, which is going to dramatically change both of those states. Because if you didn't see the maps that they had, they were pretty obnoxious in their redistricting. And now they basically said the Supreme Court's in both states knocked them down, put out new maps. The Republicans are saying, no, we need to be able to cheat. And three Supreme Court justices said, yeah, they need to be able to cheat. Ooh, wow. Adam, how are you today?
Not too bad. Yourself, mister?
I'm doing fine. Doing fine. Did you do anything fun this week? Anything exciting and interesting?
I was just actually in here all weekend.
Well, that's
so I had a fantastic weekend doing Ghost Box on Sunday.
Oh, nothing wrong with shows on, and shows Bakken's on great. Bakken's oh, yeah. great. I love having Greg Bakken on the air. Were you here for that new gardening show we got on the weekends now?
Yeah, I did hear a portion of that. I was coming into the studio at that point, and oh my goodness, my wife loved it.
Very good. Very nice. I got out a little bit this weekend. Was down in beautiful Hello Lakeville South. I was in your school this on Saturday. My kid was in a regional jazz band. So we did that, and I hung around Lakeville South. Very nice. God, every time I go down there, I remember when I was back in the 90s, and I drive down to Iowa because I lived down in Iowa. I was working down there. And I'd go past, you go past, you know, Burnsville, Buck Hill, you know, pretty much it ended after that. And then there was one McDonald's rest stop, which was that Lakeville, is it County 70. And that was it. And that was out by itself. There was nothing out there. And yeah. Now it's pretty much all built up down there. It's a great part of town. We've talked with quite a few Democrats of the day over there. So did that. Went yesterday to the Guthrie Theater. The Tempest is playing over there. Have you ever seen the Tempest?
Yes, I have many years ago.
It was just an astounding presentation of it. It's just over there. And, you know, the Tempest, this is all personal preference. You look at Hamlet. Hamlet's like the perfect play. I mean, because there's not a wasted scene, a wasted actor, a wasted line. It's not. It's just the entire thing, top to bottom, is perfect. Macbeth, I'd make an argument, is in there too. Taming of the Shrew, Othello. You can go through this. The Tempest. The one problem with Tempest is there's a few characters in there, and Shakespeare kind of does a yada 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 and end. It doesn't. Not all of them, just a little bit. But that's what I think. What the Guthrie did is magnificent, and they have their take on it, their presentation of it, just spectacular, and just some of the acting in there. The guy who played Ariel was phenomenal, was absolutely phenomenal. What was his name? Michael King is Tyler Michaels King and Regina Marie Williams, who played Prospero.
Yeah.
Prospero in that. Mm-hmm. Both of them. Unbelievable. Some of the best Shakespearean acting I've ever seen. The sprites. I don't want to ruin it. I'm not going to say anything. But the sprites, the love sprites show up.
Yeah.
Magnificent. Magnificent. And the one guy is dressed kind of like Bowie from like the 70s, and it's fantastic.
So he's got like the Ziggy Stardust.
That in there. It was really good.
I've got to see this.
Oh, you do. It's over there for a while. It runs through April, I think it is. So go see that. So I did that and enjoyed myself quite a bit. I want to bring up, if I can, though, about both of those things. I was at that jazz concert down at the school district, and I was at the Guthrie. And we are still in a pandemic, and I understand things are getting better, but I want to give, I mean, if you ever want a textbook lesson on how you can open up a theater correctly during a pandemic, the Guthrie Theater does a magnificent job. You still need to bring your proof of vaccination. You still have to wear a mask. You cannot get into the play unless you bring both. So you have to bring both. You show them then. And then they make you wear the mask the entire time, as you should. You're in a fairly tight, confined space. You do not want to breathing all over people during a pandemic, which we are still in. As much as the numbers are getting better, I'll get to the numbers here in a second, but there still is a lot of COVID out there. Which was interesting because there was a guy, and he was wearing one of those puffy jackets. I think it's the Canadian Goose guys, you know, one of those puffy jackets. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, he's wearing one of those, and he keeps pulling the mask down. And the ushers came on down and said, "Please, could you put your mask over your nose?" Wasn't yelling, wasn't screaming. Just, you know, that's part of the deal. You knew this when you came in here. You being a dinkus with your puffy jacket and keep pulling it down because you think you're getting away with something. Stop being a jerk, man. Just stop. And I didn't say anything to him because, you know, it's not my job. I don't want to have another major incident at the Guthrie Theater like the one woman who could not stop screaming. That was interesting. But, you're absolutely, you know, come on, don't be a dinkish. Now, there was a woman, I will say there was an elderly woman who was right next to us, who as well had not put her mask on. But I don't think that was by intent. I think she just missed because she went to get some gum and, you know, don't blow a bubble, get your mask on. That's not going to go well. But it's just FYI, Matt's safety tip for the day. But I think she just kind of got her mask on wrong. And she was like, she goes, oh, I am so sorry. And she puts her mask on like this. You know, she's not looking over her shoulders like, is he gone far enough? Look at me. The mask is off my face. Stop being a dingus. I went to, when I was down in Lakeville, I was down there. And, these were regional jazz bands. You know, a lot of these kids were coming from rural parts of the state. And so you have people who are coming from areas where COVID's a myth. That's all made up stuff. And so I have no idea. I have no doubt, rather. I should have no doubt that there was going to be plenty of people who are there who weren't wearing masks, and mission accomplished. We wore our mask because there's still a pandemic down. But I will say most people kind of spread out. They weren't, right on top of each other like sometimes you get. And so, it's kind of one of those things where you just got to be careful. And in the case of the jazz band concert, there was no the sign on the stage, we recommend masks. But, there are people who are like, I ain't going to be inconvenienced at all. All right. I didn't think wearing a mask was that much of an inconvenience, but okay there. And by the way, if you put a basic mask on your face and you can't breathe, dude, you need to get to the hospital immediately because you got some serious health problems and you really need to go to the doctor, okay? Seriously, don't give me that crap because I can call you on it. If you are having a problem by putting on a surgical mask and you can't breathe, well, then you have a serious health issue that you need to go get checked out, unless you're just making it up to be a jackass to try to find some way to get around it because you just don't want to do it. It's one or the other. So are you the jackass or do you have the health problem? So I don't have any problem in saying that. But like I said, the Guthrie, they do a pretty good job. And I'm pretty surprised that, that they actually even had someone there because they knew what the rules were when they came in. And yet, there are too many people that think the rules don't apply to me. Nor does style, judging by your puffy jacket, dude. That was one grossly ugly jacket. Dude, you need help with that, man. Let's do the Minnesota coronavirus update for you. I'll take a shot at the puffy jacket guy. No, that's easy. It was a puffy jacket. What are you? Is it a flotation device? You got McFly. Monday's the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Monday's COVID-19 update from the Department of Health includes 908 newly reported cases, 18 newly reported deaths. 18. Don't tell me this pandemic's over. Do not tell me this pandemic's over. 18 newly reported deaths. 908 newly reported people sick. State's COVID-19 death toll now is 12,201. This is the 24-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Friday. The three-day weekend will be released tomorrow. Minnesota's test positivity rate on the seven-day rolling average down again, 4.7%. Basically, anything over 5 is a high community spread, so we're getting on the right side of that number now. Through March 3rd, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota is 418. That's down from 472 reported on March 3rd. Of those hospitalized, 57 people in intensive care, down from 60. 361 are in non-ICU care. That's down from 412. It's the fewest ICU COVID patients since there was 57 in Minnesota in July 27th. It's the fewest non-ICU COVID patients since there was 353 on August 19th. As of March 3rd, the state reported that 3,882,027 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,665,186 people have completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 2,155,724 third dose booster shots. Get vaccinated, please. Seriously, get vaccinated. Wear a mask. Social distance. This is not going to be over for a while. And once again, most of the regulations, they've been lifted. There are still some businesses and some buildings that are going to require you to have a mask on. Might I make the point is that if you're in any place where there's a lot of people that's indoors, it's probably a good bet. This upcoming weekend, I think we're going to the University of Minnesota gymnastics meet. So I'm going to go. I don't know if that's in Ritter or if that's in it's in the sports pavilion. I'm not sure where they have that. But I can tell you one thing that's going to happen. I'm going to be wearing a mask because I'm going to be indoors and there's going to be a lot of people around. Ta-da! Doesn't make me weak. Doesn't make me, a lemming. No, it makes me, say I'm going to care about my fellow man. It's that simple, that easy. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. Those have been my consistent standards. Some people have fought me. I have been somewhat stunned by that. Still am today. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. I'll show you. Oh, okay. All right. All right. That would seem like a cry for help. But the society is only going to be as safe as the people that are in it. And as long as we still have people who are, especially you're in the Guthrie Theater, for goodness sakes, dude, you're around a lot of elderly people who are catching, they're at a Saturday or a Sunday 1 p.m. showing of The Tempest. It's going, there, trust me, the amount of retired drama teachers in the place, because your pound for pound ratio was pretty high in that. I can tell you that right now. Put your mask on. Don't jeopardize other people just because you're a selfish jerk. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take the break a little bit early. We'll come on back. We'll get into some other issues as well. No Democrat of the day today. I tried calling about 15 of them. They didn't. None of them got back in touch with. If it's not important for you, why is it important for me? I don't know. Needless to say, I beat my head against the wall for a good chunk of the day trying to get a Democrat of the day. Sometimes you have to punt. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I want to do some COVID stuff, or not COVID stuff, Ukraine stuff here, I should mention. But first, I got to mention that thank you very much to Todd Kola. Todd sponsors AM 950 radio right here, and we're very grateful. Now, if you don't know, Todd used to live here. He moved to Spain. Yeah. I'm sure the food is delicious, as well as the Spanish wine. I've had it. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal, and he's out. He loves it out there, but he still is a big fan of the station. Thank you very much. He knows he can't necessarily go to our customers that advertise here because that's a bit of a commute. So what he does is he sponsors the radio station. You can too if you'd like. 952. Oh gosh, now all of a sudden I'm blanking.
Don't ask the new guy for
946-8885. That's what it is. 952-946-8885. 952-946-8885. That's the business line number. Give them a call if you'd like more information on this. Now, check this out. Now, Todd is just a cool guy. This week we're going to promote the organization Lifeline Ukraine. It offers mental health counseling to Ukrainians. I'm sure that they are working as almost a triage unit in a military base at this point. There is a guy named Paul Nyland in Kyiv. He's lived there for 19 years. He's the director of this nonprofit organization. Todd talks about how he's donated. And by the way, if you donate 1,500 UAH, that's around $50. Okay. So you make a donation if you can. He's a strong presence out there, Paul Nyland. And thanks, Paul. I do appreciate all you're trying to do. All my best to you, your family, everyone you know out there in Kyiv as the Russians are bearing down on you there. The Lifeline Ukraine. Lifeline Ukraine. I'll put a link out there. But here's where Todd Kola gets even cooler. And this is cool. He's booking Airbnbs in Kyiv, in Ukraine, right now. Not going to go there, but he's booking them and paying for them and letting the people there keep the money. That's fan-freaking-tastic. This is I don't know if anyone else has done this, but this is a great idea. Go to Airbnb, reserve rooms all throughout Ukraine, and pay the people so they get paid. That is a great way to show support for the people of Kyiv. This is a note he got. Hi, Todd. It's very kind of you to support ordinary people in such a way. Sorry, but unfortunately, I don't have much free time to answer. The money will be paid as a salary to my employees so they can survive through this horrible time and make a donation to the needs of the army. Thank you for your support and not forgotten. Hope to host you in the future. God bless you and save Ukraine. So I want everyone right now, at some point tonight, go to Airbnb, go to whatever rental, is it Vrbo? I mean, I don't know. I don't use those, Adam. It's the Airbnb is the one that's the common one, I think it is, right?
Yeah, Airbnb is the most common. And there have been a couple of hashtags on Twitter about doing what you were just saying, going to the Airbnb, buying them. First one I heard it from was voice character actor Tara Strong. She had it yesterday.
Okay, yeah. So it does, there's a lot of characters, including a lot of them from the Teen Titans. Mm-hmm. And of course she was, what was the character from Loki? Oh, Miss Minutes?
I don't watch Disney.
Oh, for God's sakes.
I'm a DC guy.
Oh, for God's sakes, man. Really? It's a good movie franchise. Oh, he's got his Batman jersey on. Did you go see the movie this weekend?
Not yet. I'm going to wait until it releases on HBO Max. My wife has an autoimmune disease. I'm not doing anything outside of Renaissance Festival that's outside currently.
Okay. Good for you. All my best. I've heard it's pretty good, so enjoy when it comes on out. You can, while you're waiting, you might want to go get Disney Plus and check out some. The Marvel movies are pretty good. I mean, I just, one or two of them has got a little bit of a edge of your seat kind of moment in it, all right?
I've got Plus. My wife is a huge Star Wars Mandalorian. I'm like, that's great, honey.
That's right.
I like Harrison Ford. Once he was not in Star Wars, I didn't care.
Well, we shouldn't ruin anything for anyone out there because, well, I guess we can, you know. He's not going to do anymore, really, is he, at this point? He's done.
Yep. The next thing I know of is that new Indiana Jones. They're going to basically try to erase the Crystal Skull movie, and there's supposed to be another indie coming out. That'll probably be the next one I go see in theaters.
All righty. Well, here's what you can do, all right? We got sidetracked with Tara Strong. Here's the deal. Go find Airbnb, book out any hotel room that's available in Ukraine. Seriously, they'll need the money. They'll need the help. And as you heard, this is going to help the people. It's going to help the military. If you can't send them an anti-tank weapon, well, this is about the second best thing you can do. All right. So go out there. Fantastic idea. Todd's absolutely spot on. I'm glad to be working with you on this. It was interesting. I saw today this is from Mark Hertling. He posted this out there in regards to this. He's a retired soldier. He's got a long history in the military. This is what's been reported of losses by the Russians. Now, by the way, just now, it's reported the second Russian general has been killed over there by the Ukrainians. The Vitaly Gerasimov, the deputy commander of Russia's 41st Army Ground Forces, was taken out in the city of Kharkiv. This comes days after the previous reports that Major General Andrei Sukhovetsky, also deputy commander of the 41st Army, was also taken out by a Ukrainian sniper. The losses here, now, I'll save the one that's the most questionable, but a lot of this I've seen somewhat validated through international, other reporting that's been going on. 50 MLRSs, those are the mid-range rocket launchers, two boats, 454 cars, 60 fuel tankers, maybe one of the reasons why that convoy hasn't gotten down to Kyiv yet, 7 UAVs, 23 anti-aircraft warfare, 999 armored personnel carriers. That's outstanding. If you've been able to take out that many, because, I mean, let's face it, most of those are probably going to have troops in them, so you're taking them out as well. 117 artillery pieces, 290 tanks, 68 helicopters, 46 planes. Once again, that Ukrainian Air Force is badass. They are badass. They are taking on a much larger force, a much better equipped force, and they are shooting down a lot of stuff. Outstanding there. Here's the question one. How many Russian troops have passed away? The estimates here are 11,000. Now, that seems a little bit more on the high end, but there were reports from international news outlets in Belarus that the entire country of Belarus's every morgue was full with Russian troops, that they weren't sending them back to Russia, that they were sending them to Belarus, and that they were literally overwhelmed. Also, that they had shipped incinerators to cremate soldiers' bodies in Ukraine to prevent them from coming back home because they do not want people seeing the coffins coming back. So that gives you an idea exactly who Vlad Putin is. He's desperately trying to hide his losses here. Some people have made the point, it's like Russia still is the overwhelming favorite in this fight, but the others have made the point too, is if the Ukrainians can hold off for about 3 or 4 weeks, this is a kind of loss you can't have as the superior forces, and be able to still work. You're losing, I mean, what's a plane cost? $20 million, $25 million? They've lost 46 of them. That's close to $900 million. Yeah, about $900 million in planes alone. 68 helicopters. Those, I bet, are pricey. 68 of those. I mean, what's that? $10 million. Maybe it's a little cheaper than a aircraft, but that's $10 million. That's, you know, God. $680 million in helicopters. All the artillery pieces they've lost. The 60 fuel tankers with all the fuel in them as well. That's a lot of loss of equipment alone, let alone talking about the loss of troops. And you haven't even gotten to the toughest part. The street-by-street fighting you're going to have to incur to go in through these major cities. And that, trust me, as a person, as U.S. Army, I can tell you, one of the first things when we got into our base, they talked about, we went through training, they said, by far, urban combat is the hardest to do. It is absolutely the hardest to do. There's just so many points you can be attacked. It's they're, you know, almost to a point, it's not worth your time going through some major cities. But the Russians are going to have to if they're going to take over Ukraine. And then comes the occupation. Good luck. Good luck with that. Jeez. I can't even imagine the daily death count a occupation's going to have for the Russian forces. 20, 30 a day. They're going to have a draft in Russia to send people over there. If Russia keeps losing like this, they're going to come a point where Vlad Putin, you will see this. If in the next few weeks, if Vladimir Putin comes on out and he makes the comment, you know what, we're gonna take the areas we've conquered and we're gonna create, that's gonna be the new border. That's an admission from him. They've lost too much that they can't continue this. So before they get to that point, I imagine all hell's gonna break loose and they're gonna fire everything they've got at them. But the reality is that I'm going to be honest with you. I think it's going to be something where they're, if the Ukrainians can hold off, if they can just hold off, Russia is going to lose. And anything outside of complete domination of Ukraine is Russia losing, because this is a fight they never even anticipated was going to be there. People for centuries will look at what the Ukrainians have done here as a textbook example of how a small, understaffed military with lesser equipment can absolutely control a battlefield. Outstanding. Outstanding. I'm against war, but I am for people defending themselves, especially from evil tyrants who are basically the modern-day equivalent of Hitler. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, Crooners is fantastic. If you haven't been out there, it's been named one of the best jazz performance places in the cities and in the country as well. So go check that out. Crooners back open again. Highway 65, just north of Moore Lake, right north of 694. A fantastic place, and the food's sensational, too. The food is absolutely sensational. 952-946-6205. Uh-oh, could it be more problems for Dr. Scott Jensen, or as like we call him, the witch doctor, because we don't know which doctor's going to show up. Is it going to be like a doctor, or is it going to be the guy who's like, vaccines make your blood green? Is it? We don't know which doctor is going to be, so we call him the witch doctor, Dr. Jensen. Six-month-old video of GOP gubernatorial candidate Dr. Scott Jensen, in which he appears to smile and joke about getting help from Mr. Putin, is drawing renewed attention from his opponents. Ruh-roh. Well, okay, I don't know how much trouble this is going to be. I'll explain that here in a second. The clip, highlighted on March 3rd by former Minnesota Republican Party Deputy Chair Michael Broadkorb, is from September of 2021, months before the Russian invaded Ukraine. In it, Jensen explains to the crowd why he was on the Moscow News one day. Where are you now? You were on the Moscow News, you say. Wow, that's kind of interesting. It's unclear which Russian news station Jensen was referring, though many thought the most prominent networks such as RT, Russia One, and First Channel are controlled by the Russian government, which they are. They've actually been shut down by people. Jensen says the segment was about how in America, they're so afraid of the truth that a doctor who tells you the truth gets into trouble. Wow. You're actually calling out America because you think Putin, the guy who's basically threatening anyone who talks about what's going on in Ukraine in his country with jail time, that he basically is shooting straight. Okay. Sure. Tell me more, doctor. Jensen speaking energetically, I've never really experienced any help from Mr. Putin, but I'm getting it. And the line draws laugh from the crowd as Jensen shifts to explain this was a sign that his life was changing. Jensen says he was under investigation in 2020 by the state medical board for spreading COVID misinformation, which came after he compared the virus to the flu and suggested Minnesota's COVID death numbers are being exaggerated. He lied. He lied. Broadcorp, a critic of Jensen's, and if you're not paying attention, Michael Broadcorp, who we've had on the air multiple times, is a Republican. But he's terrified of where this party has gone, and he looks at Jensen as the example of the problem. And to a point, he's right. If Jensen does win the Republican nomination, it's probably going to doom Republican candidates up and down the ballot. But here we are. And I'll get back to that in a second. Broadcorp called the candidate's apparent enthusiasm for support from Russian-owned state television appalling, and the next day, one of Jensen's key opponents, Michelle Benson, also issued sharp criticism. Benson can't come up with an original idea to save herself. Anyone who remembers history knows that the KGB-trained, power-hungry leader is nothing to joke about, Benson tweeted. Jensen's attempt to seek applause from praise from Vladimir Putin is another disappointing example of his bad judgment. Agreed. As of Monday morning, none of the other leading gubernatorial candidates seeking the GOP endorsement had commented on the matter via social media or in a state news or in a news release. I'll get to that in a second here. Jensen has countered the criticism from Benson, calling her comment shameful and disgraceful and accusing her of getting in the mud with baseless smears and far-left talking points. Dude, we've got video. I mean, seriously, I almost kind of think that Dr. Scott Jensen is going to be the kind of guy that when he's confronted, like, with his stances on vaccines and masks and stuff like this, to prevent from having to answer it, he's going to stick his fingers in his ears, close his eyes, and scream, I can't hear you, I can't hear you, I can't hear you. And then when the video's over, he's going to say, see, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's going to think that that's actually legitimate defense. That's the impression I get from the guy, at least. In a statement shared with Fox 9, he also called it ridiculous to suggest he praised Putin and said his words were no endorsement of Putin, passively or otherwise, and he in no way endorsed me. The Democratic Governors Association, a political organization that supports current Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, also highlighted Jensen's comments, saying his refusal to apologize and subsequent jab at Benson are evidence the GOP field is divided. Senator Matt Klein, DFL from Mendota Heights, also shared the video of Johnson's comment calling the candidate's position on the COVID dangerous and unscientific. He also said it was evidence Russia has weaponized COVID misinformation, which had been reported on and verified since the early days of the ongoing pandemic. Jensen is self-described COVID kook. Skeptic. Skeptic is the word. There's a K in there. Sorry. My bad. COVID skeptic has routinely cast doubt on the effectiveness of COVID vaccines, have touted unproven treatments for COVID, such as ivermectin. Hey, it's what horses get, and you put it up your butt. I think that's actually the marketing slogan. I just kind of get this mental impression. Someone's like walking past the farm and tractor store. Hey, ivermectin, it's for horses, but you put it up your butt. Hey, honey, do we got some of these? We need to take this home. I'm loosening up my pants anyway. No, you're not supposed to put, don't you yourself or don't you ask a friend to place a horse dewormer up your backside. No, I can't believe I've actually gotten to the point where I can say this as Matt McNeil radio host. That's not medically sound advice. That is, I can actually counter a doctor on that. Usually I try to stay in my own lane, but hey, if your doctor is suggesting to drop trow and spread them and grab the ivermectin, that's not good medicine. I'm gonna say it's a horse dewormer, kids. It's for horses. Yeah. Tonight for dinner, we're going to give you dog food. It's food. It says food in the title. Dog food. There's no dogs in there. It's just food. See? Logic. I don't think, I'm not sure if he's ever said to actually insert the ivermectin in the nether regions. I don't know if that's ever been a policy of his, but he's been a big fan of the ivermectin. And there's a lot of people that did indeed. For a lot of guys that are uptight about sex, you like putting a lot of stuff up your backside. I'm just going to say it. I mean, someone has to say it to you guys. Is it a gateway thing? You know, is it all of a sudden, where did my coffee cup go? Never mind. No. Also, he called for civil disobedience and respond to COVID vaccine and testing rules. He doesn't appear to believe the widely proven test results of the 2020 election. He doesn't believe that either. He won statewide Republican straw poll for governor, though the results have since been coming under question for discrepancies. But that sounds like, as I said, might actually be more of a situation where many people didn't want him to win. So, all right, let's back this up for a quick sec, okay? The Republicans got this unspoken problem, and this is a very legitimate problem. In Republican strongholds, Vladimir Putin is a hero. They won't ever be able to say exactly why in these Republican strongholds, but it's basically because they feel as if he is the embodiment of white power, that this is someone that's going to go in there and get rid of the inferior races and attack people they don't like and kill them. And we'll go after gay people, we'll go after the minorities, we'll do whatever he needs to, and is willing to lock up his own people unless they believe what he says. And trust me, there is this element of the modern Republican voter that loves this stuff, that loves him, that is secretly rooting all day long for Russia to win this. That is the ugly truth about this. So I know what Broadcorp is trying to do. I just don't know if that's going to necessarily sway too many of his voters. As a matter of fact, it might endear him more to them. It might endear them more to them. And it is remarkable to me that this is the problem that you have, that you can basically have the looniest of loony people that you can have that can believe these things. And they're the people that select who is going to be your candidate. If Scott Jensen becomes the nominee for the GOP, it is a nightmare scenario for them. It really is. Because you can pick him apart. And yes, Jensen probably will do, you know, my guess would be he would do the put his fingers in his ear, close his eyes tightly and scream, I can't hear you, I can't hear you, and act like I never said any of that stuff. But when it comes to the general election, but right now, I don't think the guy has any intention of trying to come back to the moderate side. So it just comes down to individuals within the Republican Party, the people that choose the candidates. They basically, you've welcomed the crazy train into the party. And I don't know how you turn that off. I don't think this is nearly the campaign ender these people think it is. And as in regards to, by the way, of the people that do not think that the 2020 election was fair, Minnesota Reformer had this story. A former small-town Minnesota mayor and a retired Army captain from Texas have been traveling the state claiming the 2020 election was stolen from former President Trump and other Republicans, including GOP U.S. Senate candidate Jason Lewis. Trump supporters and members of the America First movement, armed with sophisticated-seeming but ultimately debunked statistical analysis, have bombarded local and state officials with questions, demands for audits, and even threats about unfounded election conspiracy theories. The Secretary of State's office gets a steady stream of messages on email and social media saying things like, you're going to jail tomorrow, or U.S. Marshals are knocking. No, you lost. And by the way, can I make the point here? We are in Minnesota. There are paper ballots. If you want a recount, you can just pay the money and recount the ballots. You can count them all. And funny, none of these people want to actually do that. None of these people actually want to do that. The cowboy and the self-described nerd drew hundreds of people to what they call Behind the Election Corruption Curtain events in Brainerd in December and Monticello last month. Wearing a button-down shirt with a black leather vest, jeans, and cowboy boots, Seth Keschel of Fort Worth is the headliner, bringing military pedigree, Texas twang, and swagger to the show. "I think y'all need to stir up a lot of crap in the state," Keschel told the crowd in Monticello. "Y'all are complacent." The alleged logic: there is no way the election could have turned out the way it did based on his analytics of the percentage of voters who are registered in each party through Minnesota doesn't have partisan registration. So I don't know how he's getting that. Compared to the actual votes for each party and population growth of the past two decades. Okay. I don't think he knows Minnesota. The problem, his predictive modeling makes no account for how voters' behavior may have changed from one election cycle to the next. A Harvard University political scientist who reviewed Keschel's claim found no evidence of fraud. Secretary of State Steve Simon has said Keschel is comparing 2016 to 2020 and saying things changed. "That's not evidence of anything bad or wrong. That's evidence of democracy in action," Simon said. "Voters and people change their mind, and there's nothing suspect about that." Yeah, that's it should be. If Trump won in 2016, he should have won in 2020. That's their argument. And by the way, and what they're also their argument is, they keep getting asked, "Okay, where's your evidence?" And they come down and they say, "We don't have any evidence. But if you give us all the ballots and you give us and leave us alone in a room for 15 days, we'll come up with the evidence." I mean, that's what they're trying to argue. And when people say, no, that's not, I mean, if you have evidence of wrongdoing, let's do a full investigation, but you don't have any evidence, you want to go on a fishing expedition and hope that there's evidence. And they're like, yeah, you know, evidence. And you're like, well, okay, no. Funny, no one claimed fraud in 2012, or for that matter, in any other dozen consecutive Democratic victories in presidential elections here, or the Democrats' records of statewide election victories going back to 2006. But nope, not at all. The explanation would seem to be uncomplicated. And by the way, none of them are arguing that the Senate didn't go to the Republicans in 2020. None of them are arguing that. They are somehow arguing that the only fraudulent votes on an individual ballot are somehow the ones for Trump, and that even though there apparently was this cabal in place that was going to change all the votes to something, that they basically said, we're not going to make the Democrats win the Senate because we want to throw them off the trail. See, they don't, they're idiots. They're all idiots. The evidence points to there being more Democratic-leaning voters in Minnesota than Republicans. Ta-da! There you go. Keschel, who would not be reached by... And by the way, it should be noted, in 2016, Hillary Clinton won Minnesota. It's that simple. It's just that simple. But not for these guys. They want to do full forensic audits. And once again, we've had Secretary Simon on the show. There is no official process called a forensic audit. They have no idea what these guys are asking for when they ask for a full forensic audit, because there isn't a process called that. That's just a way for them to basically, they created their own policy and way to do things. They want to do a forensic audit, full forensic audit. But yet they don't want anyone to watch them do it. They don't want to be able to do it under microscope or management or with witnesses. And by the way, they could do it tomorrow if they just paid the money to get the ballots and go. They could do this. Keschel declined to give USA Today any evidence to support his claim, saying, if I sent everyone information, I'd get nothing done. Or you'd prove your point. It's one of the two. You could prove your point. I mean, this is the new thing, isn't it? This is the Michael Lindell thing. I've got tons of evidence this has happened, but I'm not going to share it with anyone because he doesn't really have evidence. He's just saying he's got evidence, because if he does, basically people will realize he's a fraud, and he doesn't want people to realize it because he just wants to keep going and doing the, you know, we didn't see Sasquatch on tonight's episode, but next week there's a rustling in the bushes. Could that be Sasquatch? And the next week happens is, no, it was a squirrel. Oh, but wait a second. There's a rustling over by those bushes over there. Could that be Sasquatch? We'll have to see next week. That's kind of what they're doing. Yeah. This is who the Republican Party is. This is who the Republican Party is. They like Vladimir Putin. The people who are going to pick the gubernatorial candidate like Vladimir Putin. They still think the 2020 election was fraudulent. And there's no walking that back. So when you put this stuff out about Jensen and Putin, I think you just endear him more. Do you think that anyone in the Republican Party left Dr. Jensen's campaign and ran to, say, Michelle Benson's campaign? Of course not. As a matter of fact, if anything else, he probably said, I didn't realize he was praising Putin. Well, I need to find out more about this Scott Jensen. Good luck, Republicans. Bon voyage. Bon voyage. It's going to be an interesting rest of the year. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. So Meet Minneapolis is about to roll out its largest ever public relations campaign in an effort to improve the city's image to the rest of Minnesota and convince people to come back downtown. Last week, the city's Convention and Visitors Bureau outlined a 3-year recovery plan as it digs out from 2 years of COVID-19, civil unrest, and public safety concerns. Minneapolis hospitality businesses are suffering with the lack of tourists, business travelers. But by the way, that's not just Minneapolis. A lot of places are suffering from that. Just 30% of hotel rooms in downtown were occupied in 2021. Yeah, but you had the Delta variant surge and the Omicron surge. 68% in 2019, according to Benchmark Hospitality. Well, let's see. In 2019, what wasn't going on right now? Oh, that's right. A pandemic. I mean, come on, man. If you want downtown to look bad, this is the kind of stuff that makes it look bad. This is an Axios story. You're just making it look bad. You're comparing last year when we had two surges in COVID to the year before the pandemic began and say, see, they're just not back. Well, of course not, you fools. Dear Lord. Meet Minneapolis is partnering with other business groups on a roughly $100,000 contract with local PR firm Padilla to address reputational issues. Meet Minneapolis chair Dara Rudick said this last week's annual meeting for the organization. Meet Minneapolis pointed to a survey of meeting planners who used old age words. Okay, not a surprise here. What's the number one thing, the negative term, people think of when they think of Minneapolis? Cold. Yeah, that's right. And snow. Riot safety, protest, and George Floyd were all as well mentioned there. Major sports events are helping bring people into the city. The city is hosting the NCAA Women's Basketball Final Four. 30,000 people expected in early April. Still, how do you get anyone into this town? And everything's wet and dead. It's not the prettiest time of year in Minneapolis. It's not. We don't shine at that point. You know, May, gorgeous. June, July, fantastic. October is a gem. March to early April. What's that over there? Oh, that's the piles of sand we put on. That's now clogging up all the grass, turning it black over there. That's all wet because that's all we have to put on the road so we can drive up here. Welcome to the Twin Cities. A volleyball tournament in March will bring 25,000 people. Really? Wow. The USA Fencing National Championship will bring in 10,000 people in July. There you go. Getting conventions and business travel back is key to a full rebound. Minneapolis CEO Melvin Tennant said recovery in that area remains 3 years away. The PR campaign will target people living within 50 miles of Minneapolis and focus on convincing local brand ambassadors to visit and enjoy the things that make Minneapolis special. Meet Minneapolis is lobbying the Minnesota legislature for a bill that would allow hotels and municipalities to create tourism improvement districts that would increase funding and marketing their cities. Don't worry, but hey, they don't want to do that. Okay, let's make sure we understand something. The negative impressions of Minneapolis are pushed primarily by Republicans who are using it as a campaign talking point in their districts. As I was in the deep, dark city, and I had to go in there and fend for my life as I went to a Brugger's. That's their mentality. That's what they want to say. The reality is it's not nearly that bad. I was downtown yesterday, for goodness sakes. It was fine. How many times did I get carjacked? None. How many times did I get robbed? None. Is it a city? Does that stuff happen? Yes. But I'm tired of people vilifying my town. I love Minneapolis. I love St. Paul. I love this city. I will not stand by why people vilify it just for their own personal gain. Go to Minneapolis. It kicks ass. We are back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.